I bet you thought we'd gone quiet on you, didn't you? Well, not on your Nelly. Yes, lovely people, Handcut Radio is back, and about time too. We're kicking off a season dedicated to fresh perspectives in British menswear, celebrating young brands, creatives and disruptors. And this week's guest is the perfect place to start. Jojo Elgarissa is a vintage dealer and curator and the founder of Rag Parade, an eclectic vintage menswear store in Sheffield. We spent the day with him a couple of weeks ago, and it was one of the most enjoyable days we've had working on Handcut Radio this year. Jojo is a ball of energy, full of jokes, quips, opinions, electric ideas, and he's refreshingly straightforward to boot. We loved catching up with him, and I hope you will too. Oh, and one word of warning for those of a sensitive disposition or tender years, Jojo's not afraid of colourful language either. So, here goes nothing. Jojo, what a delight to be here. This has been a little pilgrimage for us this morning up on the train into Sheffield, into your little, what do I call it? Your sort of emporium.
Nice, yeah.
Have
you brought any gold, frankincense and myrrh with you?
Yeah, sadly not, I'm afraid, yeah. we don't, Handcut Radio is fresh out of myrrh. We've wanted to come up and chat to you for ages, so it's great to finally be here.
My pleasure.
Thanks for being a part of season four. I'm going to jump straight in because we've had a coffee and I'm high on caffeine and we've been nattering away already for a good hour. You told me before the microphones went on that your mum was an antiques dealer.
Yeah, still is, yeah.
Right. So there's a link there between what you do today as a kind of a vintage dealer and a curator and what she did, I guess. Talk to me about what it was like growing up in a house full of antiques and...
Yeah, I suppose when I grew up for like a house full of, as a northern word, I don't know if you know it, rammel, as they call it, which basically means like accumulation of old shit. And so I always grew up around old stuff, not just like furniture, but I mean like the plate we was eating off was knackered, the knife and forks were knackered and old, everything was old. So I suppose it, like subconsciously, it all slipped into me, you know what I mean? Like, there was, you know, my mum was always into old fabrics and clothing and stuff from like the 20s, the 30s and before, but not in a contrived sort of way, not in like the sort of way where you go to a vintage fair and you see a woman that turns up in a tracksuit and then she goes, oh, I best go and get changed and put on my 1940s outfit, in like more of a natural way where that's just what she liked and she grew up liking that old stuff. Then so I suppose that's where it came through. And then when I got to about, when I was a kid, I grew up like buying secondhand stuff from the charity shops and stuff like that, and then it kind of just grew from there, I suppose.
Right, but then I want to sort of piece this together a little bit.
Yeah,
because
it's a bit messy at the minute.
No, it's all right, it's great. We've just had some good some really interesting anecdotes about how you came to be in this shop. So before you started actually buying and selling clothing, you were working as a chef.
Yeah, so I did 2 years at catering college, which is pretty hilarious. Like, first day I got there, like I was like, it's the first time in my life I felt like I've got a really high IQ, because like, I'm stood there and people don't even know how to boil an egg. I was like, oh my God, this is depressing. At school, I suppose I was a bit of a tearaway, a bit of a rogue. So the teachers always used to say to me, you're never going to amount to nothing, because you on paper I was really clever, but my attention span was like zero. So I couldn't focus on anything, you know. Right. So if we were trying to learn about algebra, I was more interested at like throwing like an orange at someone's head, or you know what I mean, like just doing something daft. And I think when I started working in kitchens, I suppose it gave me a slight bit of discipline. Mm-hmm. But I realized like when I actually got into working, I was like, oh God, do I want to spend like 10 years peeling potatoes or, you know, frying an onion? It's hard work, you know what I mean?
And long shifts.
Yeah, so I end up meeting two girls that I knew that had a shop, and they said to me, oh, well, if you want, you can sublet this rail. Like, we've had a friend that's had it and he don't want to do it anymore, so if you want, you can have it for 50 quid a week. So I had this rail that was pretty much like that rail there with a wooden shelf above it, and I was selling like all my old skate t-shirts and like band t-shirts, a few jackets. And then my mum always laughs about this, like some comical crap, like a few old books and like some stuffed Wombles toys and stuff like that. And just, I mean, it was
old school.
It was low end, so to speak, but it was like, it was a start. Do you know what I mean? And then I realized that I could probably make more money doing that than I could working in the kitchens, you know?
Yeah. And then that, and it just naturally kind of ballooned from there.
Yeah, it progressed from there. And then they was moving out of the shop because they got offered an old shop by, there was a woman that was actually, she was a bookbinder and she'd been there since like the 60s. And she was getting rid of a shop. And she said to Lucy, who had the shop in the forum, "Oh, I'm getting rid of the shop. Do you want it?" And she was like, "Oh yeah, definitely. I'd love it. It's amazing. Like big old shop like this on 3 floors. And they said, "Well, if you want, you can have a whole room upstairs." And for me at the time, I was probably only about 21 or something at the time. I was like thinking, fucking hell, this is a bit of a big decision, but yeah, all right, I'll have it. So I had this little room, and it was like, it was also temperamental. I had this like rail hanging from the ceiling that kept falling down, and a few old, like, I was really into handmade shoes at the time.
Right.
Like, we were selling a lot of like Trickers and Churches and John Lobs and all that stuff on the internet. Like, remember, Dan, on eBay, we was like eBay parasites. Like, so we were selling like between 8 and 30 pairs a week. So, and it started from there, and we were getting really good money for them at the time because shoe manufacturers weren't ever going into sale.
No.
So like, everything was always full price, and it was great because they were keeping the prestige of the brand, and it meant that if you picked up a second-hand pair, sometimes we were getting more money than retail for a knackered pair.
Brilliant.
And so it started from there. So we didn't have much money in the pot, but we just started slow. Yeah, and then one room came into two rooms, and then we did that for like 3.5 years, and then the shop got planned to be bulldozed, so like, right, that was all getting knocked down, so we had to, I suppose, think on our feet and try and find a new shop.
And you moved out of town a little ways, and that brings you to,
yeah, so we moved like a mile and a half out of town onto Ecclesall Road, where we are now, and a lady I know called Caroline had this shop, and she was trying to sell like a few shit flowers and some incense, and I don't think you were really quite cutting the mustard,
right?
And then ironically, there was a fucking it's never going to work, if you think about it. It's going to be a plus-size wedding shop upstairs. If you think about it, if you're a woman and you're getting married, you're going to lose a bit of weight before you get married, aren't you? So yeah, she was selling all these like fucking dresses the size of like football pitchers upstairs. And early on, I was meant to be like going into business with this woman. So I was thinking, well, I'm going to have to try and get out of this. Can't go into business for these big wedding dresses. It's like not going to work. Like, how's it going to be work? Like, you've got like an old fucking bell stuff in one window and like a massive white tablecloth in the other. So I ended up saying to the woman, like, yeah, like, we can do it, but I'm just not sure if you're going to like my clientele, because they're going to have to walk through my shop to get to yours upstairs. So in a nice way, we end up kind of forcing her out.
Right.
And like, not in a, it was just like, well, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And I just end up going to, there were like loads of people after this shop because it had the amazing shop front.
Yeah. So
it's like the only original shop front on the street.
Yeah.
So I was like, so I got this guy's number that owned the shop, and I was like, right, I'm going to have to go and meet him. So I jumped on the train, and I was like, where do you work? And he's like, well, I work in central London. I was like, well, where? So he's like, so I was like, right, I'll meet you tomorrow then, just off Liverpool Street. So I just went and met him and did the deal and said, look, I'll do it, but I want to do it on my own. I don't want to be sharing with that woman.
Right.
So I ended up giving us the shop, and then the woman was like, well, if you're having it, then you have to pay for all the carpets upstairs. I was like, I don't want your shit fucking plush DFS carpet that's 4 inches thick. So she ended up taking the carpet with her, bless her.
That was that.
Yeah, and then that was it. That was the last I saw of her.
But again, you were saying before the mics went on, you know, to walk into this shop, it feels like a proper kind of treasure trove. You know, it's exposed kind of brickwork and plaster and wall to wall, you know, that there'll be lots of lovely photographs on Instagram for everyone to check out, but wall to wall with great finds. But I think you came in and basically took a sledgehammer to what was quite a nice shop, didn't you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like it was all like twee, and you know, it was like a yummy mummy's dream. Like, there probably were women stood in here 6 years ago with calf kids and bags made out of plastic, but we've trying to change that and made it look, I suppose, like how a proper shop should look, old school. And
yeah,
it's quite interesting. Like, I had a Japanese guy once come over, and he was buying a load of stuff to sell in his shop in Tokyo, and he said, Jojo, I love your shop, I love how you've kitted it out. I said, oh, thank you. He's like, we've done our shop the same. And I was like, what do you mean? And I was like, thanks, like, nice one. Like, and he's like, we have not dusted or hoovered for 2 years. So I was laughing. I was like, well, we actually do, but I think like that, we try to just make it, I suppose, authentic.
Yeah.
In like the way that I think like an old school sort of shop should look.
No, I love it. It's wicked. It's a great place to be. I wanted to retrace my thoughts a little bit. You mentioned that very first rail, way back when,
yeah,
you started selling, had all your old skate t-shirts on it.
Yeah, yeah.
You're big into skate culture, is that right?
Yeah, I suppose I grew up like from like probably 9, 10, 11 years old skating a lot. my brother, he was always better than me, but I was always into it and into the lifestyle of it. And I think I had that, I loved the hunger of like going out skating. And like we grew up skint, like we had no money at all. Mm. Like my mum and dad split up when we were quite young, and my dad lives in Israel and my mum lives in, we grew up in Matlock in Derbyshire, so there's like nothing to do. It's like it's probably like an hour that way past Chatsworth House. And it's like, there's nothing to do there. So like, all we used to do is go skating. So I remember like, got fond memories of being like 12, 13, getting on the bus that was like £1.30 return with my mate, Bill Abubakar, proper legend. Like his dad was from Syria. So like, you can imagine we stood out like a sore thumb in Matlock. Like you had the Jew and the Muslim, like the only two like slightly mixed race kids in the whole place. And we were like best mates, like thick as thieves. But the problem was he was naughtier than me. So I guess getting all sorts of mischief together. But we'd go skating in Sheffield and we had no money, but it'd give us like that scope. Like we'd have a fiver between us and that'd be like enough for the...
Enough for a fun day out.
Yeah, like the bus and like maybe like a pack of Monster Munchie each. And then that was it. We were starving till the bus back at like 5 o'clock. And I think that culture of growing up, it kind of give you that, I don't know, you were always out hunting, even not for stuff, but for like skate spots. Like, oh, let's go and find some stairs or just something to skate. And I think that's kind of like... I think that's what got me into the treasure hunting, really. You know, like going out looking for old gear. And it's like, it is, it's like every day when you're out buying, it's like you're hunting for treasure. It's like, it's always going to retain that excitement, you know.
What sort of the breakdown between being here in the shop and kind of curating stuff versus being out and buying for you? Are you out buying a lot?
I mean, at the minute, I've been out probably buying 80% of the time just because I love it. And that's the bit that gets me excited. Selling stuff's the boring part. And I think I've always said... And like I've always said to Dan, I was like, if someone wants to buy something, they're going to buy it anyway. So never try and sell someone something. Like, you know, we never do the hard sell on anything. Like, it's like, they want to buy it, they want to buy it. If they don't, that's cool. And I think good stuff definitely does sell itself. So I think finding it is the most important thing. You know, you could have something amazing and you know that it's going to sell easy. You probably got 10 people after it, maybe 20. Yeah. So I think finding the interesting stuff is what keeps the shop like this alive and also retains interest for us as well, because if we're just looking at the same sweatshirt or the same jacket week in, week out, we're bored as well. Then we need to learn and develop as well for our own sanity, I suppose.
At what point do you think, if you trace back your journey in vintage, at what point did you start to think, oh, I'm actually like, I'm learning about all the little details of like this clothing kind of subculture or this trend or why these jackets were made? At what point did you start kind of absorbing everything? I guess it must have just happened quite naturally.
I think, well, I was always selling stuff. Even at school, I was always selling some sweets or some drinks or, you know, something.
I'm liking the hustle, Jojo. Yeah, I'm liking it.
Honestly, I was hungry. You know what I mean? I was very hungry and you know, I had good taste. So I always wanted the best shit and it was fucking hard getting it.
Yeah.
So, you know, at school, I was always trying to do something and make some money. And, you know, quite often... We'd do all right. We'd make a little bit of money and then you'd end up buying your first thing. But then at first it was all just like, it was like uneducated guesses and you were firing blanks completely. Mm. And then I think when it started becoming like really transparent is when I started actually like, you know, selling something for decent money. And I was like, wow. Like, cause when you first realize that people want to buy something off you, not that you just got lucky and sold it, it's quite interesting, you know. You're like, oh, right, so I can put it together. And then I think you get into a certain item. I remember buying like my first old Belstaff jacket. It's like, oh, this is amazing. Sold it, bought another one. And it's like, oh, this is a bit different. The zip's a bit different. And then actually becoming a geek and then realizing what every single one was and every single model.
Mm.
And I suppose as time goes on, you kind of forget some of that stuff. But you can always go back to it and look and study and think, oh, yeah, I remember all that stuff now. And I think the love affair started with shoes, to be honest, leather shoes. And it was like the intricacies of it and how well they were made and, you know, looking at the last numbers and style numbers and where they were made and which factory they were made in. And it became pretty geeky, didn't it, Dan? Like, we'd look at a pair and we'd be able to tell by the font of the handwriting which factory it was made in. And, like, stuff like that, you know, that was really, like, quite fascinating, I suppose. Because, you know, you realise that everything had an identity and everything was, you know, oh... Well, this shoe is this brand, but actually it's made by Crockett and Jones or it's made by Church's.
Yeah, you get beyond the label, don't you? And you can kind of go, oh, I know that factory made that, even though it's white label or whatever, and you can piece it all together.
Yes, I suppose that's where it started getting really geeky. And I think that's died down a bit because shoes aren't really popular anymore. I mean, not a lot of people aren't wearing shoes and I think they're just a lot more readily available. And I think people are a bit over it or they don't really care. So I think that... I mean, there are obviously certain customers that still love all that gear, but it's quite niche, I think, nowadays.
It is interesting how kind of, I think, you know, I guess the equivalent today is sneaker culture. Sneaker culture's massive.
Yeah, yeah,
but
definitely.
I do think kind of trad footwear is probably looking at a tough couple of years now. You know, what is at its core a business shoe or a formal shoe? You know, we've come out of lockdown. No one's going to the office anymore. That kind of whole workwear culture is changing. I'm going to be really interested to see how Northampton responds to that in the next couple of years and how designs kind of evolve a little bit. Anyway, let's get back on this thread. I wanted to ask then, you know, you clearly, you've been in this world for years, you've hustled, you have built the shop up from nothing by yourself. What is the kind of Rag Parade philosophy on vintage? You know, what sets Rag Parade apart from other vintage emporiums?
I suppose we've got our own identity, and we buy what we like and we sell what we like. And also, I suppose, like, compared to some other vintage shops, we sell a broad range of stuff. So the interest is quite broad. You know, because I'm not just into like 1930s to 1950s menswear. I mean, I'm a bit greedy. I like everything all the way up to like current day. And I'm not a dinosaur as well. So I'm happy to wear something modern with something old. And I think that's what makes something contemporary and look new. And I think those guys that are wearing like head to toe 40s or 50s, not to take anything away from them, that's fine. And every now and again, it does look cool. But generally, they look like they're trying to step out of a photograph. And it's not really original. It's a bit too conjured. And they've often got a big belly they're trying to tuck into a big pair of fucking Burton's pants. And it's like, but it's got a utility stamp on it. And it's like, give over yourself, mate. Go and have a hot bath. So for me, that's kind of what I find naff about the whole thing. And I think you should just wear what you like. And also, really, really important to wear what suits you. You know, whereas a lot of people nowadays will wear something because it's a certain brand. And it doesn't necessarily suit them. And I think it's about having that look and I suppose keeping it authentic and staying true to who you are. And we've always like bought stuff that we like, whether it's a 1930s bespoke suit or a Stone Island jacket from 1998 or I don't know, a pair of handmade shoes or a pair of trainers from the 80s. It's about having that, you know, having that eye for that thing that you think's cool. And
it's all about gut instinct, isn't it?
Yeah, and about the quality of it and how it's made. Like, you know, a lot of people come in here that are into old gear and they go, fucking hell, why have you got CP company stuff? And you go, well, actually, do you know about the brand? And they go, well, not really. And then you say, well, have a look at this book. And then you show them like the innovation behind it and how it's all garment dyed and some of the technology that they introduced. And like, then the left walking away going, fucking hell, that stuff's amazing. Can you get me a jacket? And I think that's what it's all about. Whereas I think a lot of places, they do kind of pigeonhole themselves a bit. And I think it's just about being open-minded and just doing what you like, I suppose.
I love, there's a lot in there that I really identify with. I love, like we've preached for a good long while on the podcast that, and I'm going to say it again, start of season four, guys, clothes are for the man who wears the clothes.
Yeah,
you know, I get really upset with how uncomfortable some men feel when they approach kind of shopping or getting dressed. It's like, no, it's all about you feeling good.
Yeah,
as long as you feel like you're buying into brands and garments and kind of trends that you genuinely feel comfortable in, that's what it's all about. Clothes are about self-expression.
Yeah, and I think it's about like looking natural as well. Like if someone looks conjured in something, it doesn't suit them, does it?
No.
Like, back to reference my mother again, she's always having a laugh. If we ever go anywhere and we're together and we see someone like head to toe in 40, she's always pissing herself like, look at him. Because it's like, you know, his shoes don't fit right and he's a bit uncomfortable. I mean, every now and again, they might look cool, but I think if someone looks natural in that, like, you know, it really suits them. Like, a good example of that is, you know Paul Brewer, who stands on Portobello Market? He's got a shop down in, I think it's in Margate, but he's always wearing like old 40s stuff, but he's wearing it in a natural way.
Mm-hmm.
So he might have like a pair of 40s pants on and like an old raggy shirt with like, you know, an old hat and a pair of knackered cricket boots, but it really suits him and he pulls it off and it's like, it's authentic.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what that look is like, whereas I think, you know, when people go too polished and refined with it, it does suit some people, but it doesn't suit everyone. And I think, and that's not, I know I keep referencing the 40s thing, but that goes hand in hand with anything. Do you know, mm-hmm. where if someone's like strapped into a load of streetwear gear, that also looks naff, doesn't it? You know,
and it's all about, and it's really interesting that you say that, because a running thread on the podcast is that really it's all about the mix.
Yeah,
I've started talking about the high low and that idea of if you've got something very tailored, like dress it down with a pair of vintage jeans that are 40 years old and have been through the washing machine 150 times. Like, if you're wearing streetwear on your top, then maybe wear like a really, really sharp pair of tailored trousers on the bottom. Like, that's what's interesting to me right now. It's that mix.
And that's what the Japanese have always been amazing at. Like, the contrast in the styles of gear that's incredibly wacky. And probably if a British guy made it, he might look a bit daft, but they just pull it off. Like, I mean, we've had some guys come in here, Dan, that are just looking insane, haven't we? Like, they come in like with a, like a pair of like weird like British Army trainers on with like a fucking suit jacket that's three times too big and like a knackered shirt and then like some modern trousers made by like North Face or something. But then it like it all works. Like, and that's amazing. I think they've always been like kings at that because they've always been into the new shit, but they've always been into the old shit as well. So, and they really know how to blend the two.
Yeah, they kind of mastered it, haven't they?
Yeah, and then you've got shops out there where you walk in and you think, well, I can see why, because they've got that culture there and you've got them selling the old with the new and vice versa. And they've just got like that, I don't know, it just all looks real. They've got a good look going on.
I should say for context, listeners, the mythical figure of Dan that you keep hearing is Jojo's colleague who's tucked away in the corner.
He's a real person.
Dan, have you been with Jojo all the way through?
I think when you first moved into the old shop upstairs...
You did the odd day, didn't you?
Like a day a week or a Saturday, yeah. So he's sort of come and gone since then for, well, about eight years.
Amazing.
He worked with the girls downstairs, so I robbed him off them. Dan studied in London something to do with fashion that he didn't really like, but some like, what was it?
Fashion buying and merchandising.
Which has worked out well, putting a few old matchboxes and knackered jeans on tables. I got on with Dan and we chatted and that, and then before you know it, we were working upstairs and not downstairs, and then they got a bit pissed off, but... yes, that was quite
it's
funny.
All worked out.
Yeah, it's all worked out in the end.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Right, I've got another one for you.
Go on.
As you've already alluded to, there's a lot of crap in the vintage market these days. You know, it's ballooned massively. There are way more dealers and it's way more accessible than it ever was before.
Yeah.
How do you personally keep the quality of what you buy and curate high? You know, is there like a certain way that you approach what you buy?
I think so. Like, I always buy stuff that I like, but then obviously you've always got to make money as well. So you've got to buy stuff that you think, well, actually I can make a bit of money on that and I can pay the bills, because there's no point in being a busy idiot and being absolutely rat or skin and not being able to pay the rent. You've got to be able to pay the rent. So like, we do a lot of contemporary stuff, and we do sell stuff from like, by contemporary I mean stuff from probably like the late 70s to, I mean, probably like early 2000s. You know, a lot of guys would think that was sacrilege by selling stuff that's not really old. But, I mean, that's all bollocks to me. I like stuff, and I like good stuff. And I think, you know, it's style, isn't it? It's not about vintage. It's about, like, the style of the stuff. And if it's cool, it's cool. And we set up probably a new Instagram page probably about a year ago. And it's just called Rag Parade Contemporary. And that's just all our modern stuff that we put on there. And it's done really, really well because... I suppose in a way, not hate to use the word, but it's probably slightly more commercial.
Yeah.
But
it's all still stuff that's got a story, hasn't it? And it's all got its own kind of patina and character.
Oh yeah, like as a general rule, we sell stuff that's made in Europe and USA and Japan, and it's all like good quality stuff. We are very fussy in what we pick.
Yeah.
I suppose we keep the quality high, but we do a mix of stuff. So, you know, we'll sell like a lot of sweatshirts from like the late 70s and early 80s that everyone can afford, because, you know, the last thing you want is a shop that's like a museum. If we get five students walk in, we want to be able to accommodate them so they can actually walk away and think, oh, I like that shop and I've been able to buy something from there.
Yeah, that's nice.
Whereas like, we did have it a bit like a museum at one point where everything was a ridiculous price and we had like loads of rare gear in the shop, and it's like, hang on a minute, I've created like a monster here, because if you get someone in that's really into it, they might come in and spend crazy money, but 90% of the people that come in aren't going to want like a first pattern, whatever. Do you know what I mean?
It's, yeah.
So you've got to have that fine balance of like getting stuff that sells and getting the really cool stuff as well. You know,
talking of really cool stuff, one of the things that turned me on to Rag Parade in the first place when I came across your Instagram a little while ago is I always think that French workwear and kind of American denim get all the glory in the vintage space. But actually over here in the UK, we have an amazing culture of workwear. Yeah. And every now and then on your Instagram, like the most amazing like general post office coat will pop up. Or like a really, really old, I don't know, like baker's jacket or a craftsman's jacket or something. Where does the kind of interest in really old school British workwear come from for you?
I mean, it's just like, it's so rare, that stuff. It's like, it's amazing, all that gear. But you just don't find it. I don't know why, but it's just, I think the French had a culture of saving stuff, and the Americans as well. They had big spaces, big houses, big barns, big open spaces. So all that gear just got shoved in barns.
Mm.
Like some of the French gear I used to find, like, was amazing because it's like it's so easily accessible. Where the British gear, it just simply like anything, it all got chucked.
Yeah,
you know, we talked about this morning with like old bottles and stuff. Like they just used in the Victorian times, I suppose, they used to drink the bottle or finish the jam jar and they just chuck it over the shoulder.
Yeah,
and then that's why there's millions of them in the ground. Whereas like it's the same with the clothing, it all just got thrown away. Like my mother was saying, like when you used to go to a boot sale or a rag yard or somewhere back in the day, she said it was full of like amazing gear. Like you'd find Victorian stuff and Edwardian stuff, and this is like probably like in the 80s, but because it was still out there. But I mean, a lot of it just got chucked because it was just rag. But if you look at some of that early British stuff, it is amazing stuff, but it is really hard to find. And I think, for saying how hard to find it is, there's not really got a great deal of value. The Japanese like it.
Right.
But it's not got the value of the American stuff or the French has got.
It's a shame. I think that's a shame. Like you presumably when you get like really, really great bits in, they go pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Like, from British workwear.
Look at this photo. Yeah, this is 1915 in Liverpool. And if you look at that, I think it's that one. Yeah, that one there. I've had these before. That's a really early British jacket with a stitched down collar.
Right.
I mean, that's like super rare because I suppose it all just got chucked. And don't forget, we're a small country on a small island. It's not like we didn't produce the numbers, did we?
No, whereas that's true.
Is in America, they produced a lot. And don't forget, our gear is all fucking wool, isn't it? And stuff. Like we didn't do that much in cotton. Whereas like, you look at America, it's all cotton and denim and stuff.
And it holds up better.
Yeah, so it lasts, whereas all the wool, I mean, even if you do find a piece, it's horrible and full of moth.
Mm.
So to find that stuff is quite hard. It's weird. And I suppose it didn't get kept for best. I mean, the British stuff that did last is like stuff that you don't really want, like morning coats and tailcoats.
And
it only got worn the odd occasion, I suppose.
Yeah. It's a shame, isn't it? We do have that culture of tailoring, but those garments are not really as usable as, again, the workwear stuff that other Western nations kind of dug into.
Yeah, definitely. So if you're like, I mean, I think it will come round, like definitely, because if the French stuff is catching up with the American gear in terms of popularity,
right?
Like, you know, a few years ago, those black moleskin work jackets that you see that are really nice. I mean, we used to sell them for like pretty cheap, like probably like 70-80 quid.
Mm.
I mean, they've probably like tripled in price now. Like, not found one for a while.
That's interesting.
But it's like all that patch stuff, it's like in Japan, I think it's like really catching up. And
yeah,
and I think also because they've been into the American stuff in Japan for so long, like probably over 30 years, they're getting a little bit bored of it. And you can walk into any generic vintage shop in Japan and find that American stuff. So the European stuff, the French and the British and all that gear, that's becoming like the new niche, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
What's your take on patchworking? Is a pretty big trend in mainstream men's fashion right now. It's coming through for autumn, winter. What's your take on kind of modern menswear or like brands making stuff brand new and deliberately aging it or patching it or darning it?
It's not for me really, because I just think if you want something like that, you just get an old one.
Get the real thing.
Yeah, like so, or you know, you wear it until it falls to bits yourself and then do them fixers. So yeah, it's not really my sort of thing, but some people can do it really well, make it look good.
Mm.
But I remember seeing an old fella in Italy with a load of vintage jeans, and he was here. He had this like machine and he was like distressing them, you know, to put all the rips in them. And they were already old, but he was making them rip because that must have been what was popular at the time.
Yeah.
And he was like doing that. I was like, what are you doing, you lunatic? Like just ruining all these nice jeans. But yeah, he must have been able to sell them quicker. So there's always going to be trends, isn't there, and all that. But I think you've got to be above all that trends and fashions and all that. It's like, I think the real stuff, if it's authentic, it doesn't need to be part of a trend, does it? Because it is what it is, and it'll stand the test of time.
Yeah.
It'll be cool the first time around and the tenth time around, I suppose.
Yeah. And it'll last that long.
Yeah, hopefully.
Brilliant. I wanted to ask, do you have any pieces that you think about from over the years where you're like, I absolutely nailed that? What's the most sort of exciting thing you've ever bought?
Yeah, I've had quite a few bits, I suppose. I mean, I had an amazing thing that I sold to Doug at the Vintage Showroom, which was, I don't really like talking about it, it was so good. It was an Egyptologist suit from like 1910 or something, or 20.
Wow.
And it was like really cool. It was just like, yeah, it's mega. It was like made in Sheffield as well. And it was like a jacket and trousers, and it was like used to fucking dig up some mummies or something. that was pretty cool. And I mean, I had, what else have I had? I've had like some amazing gear that you just think, wow. At the time, especially when I was young and a bit naive, I always think, you look at the human brain, and when you're younger than 25, your brain's still developing, innit? Mm. So you're a bit of an idiot before that. you're not an idiot, but you're just a bit more brash.
I know what you
mean. A
bit
more overconfident and a bit of an idiot. You are a bit of an idiot. And I think you just buy it, and you think that you're never going to stop finding this gear. You think it's never going to run out. And then when you've been doing it probably over 5 years, 6 years, you think, fuck me, that was rare.
Yeah.
Like, so I suppose like stuff does run out and stuff does get rarer. But I mean, like, I remember having like a motoring coat, like that's an old motoring coat, an Edwardian British one's pretty cool. But I remember having one that was like, it was like, had like a zip front, I think, and it had buttons over it. It was probably like 20s. And then it had like a big zip mat pocket in like a tan, like a dark brown, actually not a tan brown. It was like insane. And I've had some like ridiculous gear that you just think, never going to find that again.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting because there's a lot of stuff out there and there's still more gear to find, I suppose. So
awesome.
Yeah. There's a few regrets, but I think you can't regret selling anything. I think you have to just think it's gone, move on to the next thing. And I think also by having that good gear and I think the more you let go, the more it comes back to you, because you know, you're spreading the luck around a bit and you can't keep it all, because no one ever wants to buy anything from you if you're one of them people that doesn't sell anything good, because they're like, well, he just keeps all the good stuff for himself. You've got to release a few of them specimens out there, you know what I mean, to get a few back.
I love that. My next question for you was going to be, do you have any regrets or anything like professional lessons you've learned over the years? But you've kind of just answered that.
Yeah, and I've sold stuff too cheap, which is like, you know, which is always a bit emotional when you sell like something really rare and then you think after, shit, that was good. But you know, you make on other deals, so you have to just take it all within your stride. Because I think if you thought like that, you would never get up in the morning. You know, you've got to just go get out there and attack it, and then think about it all after, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant. Well, listen, I've only got one more question for you. This time has flown by.
Nice,
I've enjoyed
chef.
It.
Service, please, chef.
It's a big one, though. I wondered whether you had any kind of thoughts on how the vintage market is going to change or evolve over the next 3-5 years. Are you picking up on any kind of changes or trends that are interesting?
I'm not sure, really. It's weird because things go off the boil and come back onto the boil quite regularly. So it's like anything. It's like the art market or antiques or anything. Things are hot and then they're not again. Like, you know, the Bellstaff and Barber jackets, for example, like the four pocket trial masters or internationals. I mean, you couldn't give them away for a while, for probably like 3 years. We always sold them because we like dinosaurs, but we just couldn't really give them away. And then now, like everyone we get, I mean, there's a railful up there, I should probably photograph them. But it's just like, you know, someone in America wants to buy it, or someone in Japan wants to buy it, and they've become popular again. But they weren't for so long. They were like, you know, you could get one for like 80 quid, 100 quid, and now they've come, kind of rose back up again. And I have noticed like the Americans buying into my shit, which is weird because I've never had that before.
Yeah.
And you get the odd one that might want to buy something.
That must come through Instagram.
Yeah. And the Americans have started buying British gear, which is quite nice because I think in New York and places like that, they're probably looking at the British stuff and thinking, fuck me, that's pretty cool. And I suppose for them, it's something new again. And I think the French gear out there is worth money in America as well. So that's pretty interesting. And I think probably because they've got a lot of Bellstaff flagship stores, they're all the guys that are into menswear are looking at it and thinking, well, I don't want that plastic coated one. I want a real one. So like that's becoming a bit of a thing. So maybe something could get cooked up there. I don't know.
Right. Interesting. And do you know what? I said I didn't have any more questions, but I have got another one for you.
No worries. Yeah.
Which is, you've talked about spreading the luck around, which I think is a really lovely way to think about what you do. And I've not heard a vintage dealer say that before. I think that's really cool. But on that note, if you were going to give a piece of advice to the younger version of yourself, or someone who wants to do what you do, or someone who looks up to you, what would your advice be?
I suppose start small and keep it real, and don't try and be too greedy. Like, I think the problem is with people starting now is they think that they can make it all in a week, whereas, you know, I've done my apprenticeship, and I'd like to say that I've not even finished the apprenticeship yet. I'm still fucking at it. Mm. I'm still in the field, as you say. I'm still out there hunting, digging, looking, searching, trying to build up something. And it takes a long time. So don't try and be the first man in the queue. You've got to go slowly, build your connections, keep your modesty. No one likes an expert. No one gives a fuck about the fucking name of a flight jacket. Seriously. Like, oh, yes, well, that's actually an M42. Oh, whatever. I don't care. Like, is it nice? Is it cool? Like, yeah. Like, no one gives a fuck. So stop all that, because that'll get you nowhere, especially off like the old generation.
I love that.
And I think just go slowly and buy what you're into. But just, I think, be humble as well, because I think when I first started, I'd probably get someone in the shop that said, oh, I've got one of them in green. And you're thinking, well, they never made a green one. Or I've got one of them. And I'd probably, when I was like 21, 22, I'd be like, no, you haven't. And I'd probably argue the toss of them. But now I just nod and smile and think Dan's probably exactly the same. Just like, yeah, whatever. And I think the trick is, if you do, anyone I've met that does know the shit, they never let on they do. And I think the ones that advertently go out the way to try and talk like an expert don't get them anywhere. So I think go slow and just build it up nice and slowly. You don't need to rush into it. Like, I started with like probably like 15-20 quid, bought it, sold it, you know. It felt like I was just walking around in circles, you know, like them horses that are strapped down. It was like, you know, all the fucking grass had been emptied and I was just in a patch of shit. But eventually the bloke comes and cuts the fucking chain and you might go and find a few blackberries, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So just go slowly. go slowly.
Jojo, mate, that was what an absolute pleasure. I'm really, really grateful to you for coming on and being a part of season 4. Thank you very much indeed.
No worries. You've come to me. I didn't even have to go anywhere.
That's all right. Yeah. Glad we did. Nice one.
It's been emotional. Cheers.
Oh, it feels so good to be back on the air and to have kicked off this season with such a candid and refreshing take on the vintage scene. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. If you did, we'd love it if you'd leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening in. Positive reviews really do help to increase Handcut Radio's visibility and boost us up the charts. Huge thanks to my collaborators at Birch for producing this podcast. Birch is a London-based creative agency specialising in agile content and new era communications. Check out the agency's work at birchlondon.com. Our sound editor and theme music composer is Joe Boyd. You can hear more from him by following at This Is Joe Boyd. All that remains is to say thank you very much indeed for listening, and we'll see you back here this time next week.